Oh, man, I'm never going to make that appointment.
Now there's a car that gets you where you want to go.
Your door's ajar. Hurry up. Shut it. Come on. Time's a-wasting.
And gets you there fast.
Here, let me get it for you.
Hey!
The all-new Espresso.
We got really high oil pressure right now, but don't worry about it. That always happens to me. Say, when you get done with your appointment, what do you say we take a little spin around town? Maybe drive through the car wash a couple of times? Ooh, better yet, let's see how long it takes to drive all the way around the state.
A powerful engine created in the hills of Colombia.
Really? I'm not in this big of a hurry.
You know what you could use right now? A good shot of caffeine. Maybe one of the 48-ounce big gulps. Let's stop at this gas mark, okay? Nah, that's going to take too much time. We can just siphon some out of my gas tank at the next stoplight.
Standard features include caffeine, and more caffeine.
Have you ever tried decaf?
Bite your tongue.
Sorry.
With this 65-mile to the bean wonder, you'll never be late again.
You know, we're going kind of fast.
Fast? You think this is fast? This is nothing. We're only doing 98. You know, I can get it up to 125 easy. 130 if the wind is right.
The all-new Espresso.
Honest, officer, the car's just had too much coffee. Really?
Mm-hmm. And what have you been drinking?
Come in for a test sip today.
Welcome and thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and if you're just catching up with us, we're listening to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh as he talks about the situation in Iran.
All the things they're doing now, you're saying, are completely civilian.
Everything we know. Everything we've been able to see, not only through the IAEA, but also through about 5 years of on-the-job black operations, the most secret about which I've been writing forever. Our Joint Special Operations Command, our CIA was involved in some of them. We've not been able to find any evidence of a clandestine operations, period. So therefore, I was in Israel this April, and the Israelis told me, on background, it's always crazy to get the Israel. I had a senior Israeli intelligence officer say to me, "You're right. They did stop playing around in 03. They didn't build anything, but they looked at it. You say, you Americans believe it's because you beat up Baghdad, who disappeared. We think they did it because they saw what you could do to Baghdad and thought they would be next. But the bottom line is the same. They still stopped." And then if you ask a really serious Israeli intelligence officer, and they're good, these guys, this is – I couldn't find a way to use it because they wanted me to report what they told me as a Western source, and I wasn't in the Western world. The New Yorker doesn't play that game. So we couldn't use it. I tried like hell. But he did say to me, "Look, even if they got a bomb and they don't have one now, would they use it against Tel Aviv?" As we always say, no. The Persians aren't crazy, he said to me. They know we would incinerate them if they did that. You know, Israel's got, what, 400 bombs? 300?
Well, do we know?
We don't know. It's opaque. But yeah. They're less and less opaque.
You also have written about cyber war, and this was today in the Washington Post. Iran's nuclear program, which stumbled after a cyber attack last year, appears beset by poorly performing equipment, part shortages, and other woes as global sanctions exert a toll. So this is their civilian program we're talking about, but we launched a cyber attack against them.
First of all, the second part of that is totally right. Not because of sanctions. For some reason, the Iranians, who are so competent in computer technology, et cetera, are just having a hell of a time with enrichment. They haven't been able to it's a complicated system where you run centrifuges that turn at 100,000 cycles a second or something like that, or nanoseconds. I don't really know the technology stuff, but it's high speed turbines that isolate the 235 we need, the stuff that the nuclear core and the highly enriched stuff. And what happens is they haven't been able to get them to work. They collapse, and they've had a lot of trouble. Nobody wants to deal too much with Iranian stuff because it's also polluted. There's been a lot of problems. It has not to do with sanctions. It has to do with lack of technology. I mean, I'm told these guys, they have to bring in German automobile mechanics to fix their old Mercedes. They really aren't that competent. I'm not exaggerating. The Intelligence Committee has written papers on that. They're just not that good. The Stuxnet thing is amazing to me. Because all you have to do
– that was the cyber attack.
Famous thing a year ago where this allegedly stopped Iran in the tracks. There's no question it affected Iran. But there's also no question it affected much of the world. It affected China. It affected India. All these places were having trouble with this new cyber attack. It took them days to patch it. And if you go talk to the experts in the cyber world, there's people at California. I talked to a bunch of people about it. I'm talking about computer geeks or people academics who teach computer technology. They'll all say the best grade you can give Stuxnet, if it was aimed at Iran, which nobody knows, is it's like the great line about Wernher von Braun, that, you know, the V2 rocket scientist, he aimed for the moon, but he often hit Moscow, London rather. Remember that line? It was Tom Lehrer, one of his songs. Aimed for the moon, but he often hit London with the V2 rocket. The guy we brought back to lead our program, Wernher von Braun. I love that story. Anyway, it didn't work. It was all over the world. It was patched. Even the IAEA, one of his reports, said everything was up and running after 4 days. So the idea that somehow this magic bug, I did a piece just saying, whoa, cyber stuff is serious. It's much more serious in terms of cyber crime. But the idea of cyber war is just a fantasy. You are not going to bet everything on throwing the best thing you have at your enemy in the assumption that it's going to wipe him out. Because if he does have good defenses, and there are defenses, they're usually a little bit behind the offense, you're done. You know, if you're going to stop a Russian fleet with a cyber attack and they have figured out a way to patch it.
But you write about here. So this was December. In May, after years of planning, the U.S. Cyber Command was officially activated and took operational control of disparate cybersecurity and attack units that have been scattered around the military.
Absolutely.
So this is – we're investing in this even so. It seems
billions.
Difficult.
It's the big boon. Every new defense company now in the cyber war, it's huge because they have to outsource it. It's just look.
But boondoggle?
Oh, I just think the idea that you're going to bet everything. First of all, the idea of cyber attacks, it's CQ by. You always want to knock out the enemy's communications. That's part of war. That's always been a part of war from the very beginning. The first bombs aimed at the communications. This is not a new idea.
Right.
It's just a different way of doing it. And the notion you're going to bet all that you can do it that way is a high risk. What's more important, it seems to me, is that we are very vulnerable. One of the things about America and the whole cyber thing, one of the points I was trying to make is that everybody thought that Obama would mandate the solution to all the banks losing 8-10% a year through cyber theft is more encryption. But in order for a major corporation to spend the money on more encryption, you know, it costs them money. And secondly, it means that you're the CEO of a company and you're going to give the security guys more power than you want to give up to anybody. If your secretary, if you know the your little cutie that you're messing around with comes in one day and says, "Oh, boss, I left my crypto card, you know, at home, or I gave it to my girlfriend and she's lost it," the security guy would say, "She's got to go. You can't have somebody with not, you know, with being so careless." The boss doesn't want to give up that power. He also doesn't want to spend the money for encryption. And this government, of course, the Obama administration was faced with that issue, knew they should have mandated it. But since it was the only part of the economy in 2009 that was working and making money, they left it alone. There we are. By the way, this city is so underwater right now in real estate. That's all I hear about.
This city, Seattle?
Oh, yeah. You guys are in real trouble. I think as bad as Orlando.
No, we're not as bad as Orlando.
No, you're pretty bad. I was hearing stories. I'm here one day. I'm hearing horror stories from everybody.
We'll take a break. Seymour Hersh is our guest. Seymour Hersh has won. His books have won what? 5 George Polk Awards?
My articles, more than my
books. Your articles, yes. His books have won National Book Critics Awards. And articles, 5 George Polk Awards. Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. All right, just about. Let me go to the question of hearing and social media. So you heard horror stories from people that were underwater worse than Orlando, or as bad as.
I said that.
Yeah,
nobody said
you
that.
Said that. You said that. But as a reporter, of course, that's just where you start.
You know, here's the thing. Social networking is essential. The Arab Spring, was a function. And by the way, the poor kids who did it, they're being left in the lurch by us and the Egyptian army.
They're being arrested, aren't they?
Well, they're being, because, you know, we're not much better than it. We'd much rather have people we could control than actually a true democratic, progressive, populist uprising. These were not jihadists. These were kids, secular kids, and they just wanted a better government. They wanted more say in the government, and they're all being shoved away. And we're letting the Egyptian military play the game, and we're letting Muslim Brotherhood probably get a bigger chunk of the election results, both in Tunisia and in Egypt.
Do we have any option? Way of acting?
Are you kidding? Do you know the American military and intelligence community are the single strongest backer of the Egyptians? We have a huge facility. We work closely with the Egyptians. Egypt's always been our backbone. If you really had somebody tough and you wanted to get the fingernails pulled, you didn't send them to Jordan. You didn't send them to Thailand. They were alternative places. You sent them to Egypt.
But you're saying the military go and say, hey, we want democracy. And the Egyptians go, oh, yeah, okay.
We could put a lot of pressure on them. Instead, we're letting the Egyptians' military take in control. That's a lot safer for us. Among other things, we had the exchange with the Shalit, the prisoner. The military did that over the protests of their own people. I mean, look,
we're talking about the Israeli-Palestinian exchange.
Yeah, right. But the point being that the Egyptian military is using a little muscle there because it's not something that's popular, but it's something that's popular with us and the Israelis, that this deal was done and they orchestrated it and they got them out. And it's all positive stuff. But the bottom line is we have enormous influence that we are using. We're using it to keep them in power. We don't trust the kids. That's true democracy. We don't trust the kids. Of course we don't. I mean, that's, you know, we talk about democracy, and who do we support? Mubarak, we had a hell of a time letting Mubarak go. We support the Saudis. We support all of the countries in the Gulf, Oman, Qatar, Bahrain. We support the sheikhs and emirs that control that. What's the deal? The deal is, okay, they can repress their people all they want as long as they give us bases to keep the oil and gas flowing. That's been the deal we and the Brits have made since World War II. The implicit deal. How much do we really care about democracy? The Gulf is controlled. There's a defense group in the Gulf called the GCC, Gulf Cooperating Committee or Council, set up in the early 80s, 81, I think, or 82. It's the only defense organization in the world designed to protect from within, not from without. They're worried about all of the Pakistanis and Indians and Bangladesh who are working there. In Bahrain, the slave labor were mostly Shia. That's why they beat the hell out of them. And we stood around and watched the Khalafi family just massacre doctors and nurses as long as they were Shia. The stuff that went on in Bahrain makes even Bashar's action in Syria. It doesn't make it benign. What he's doing is wrong and horrible, but it's equally as pernicious and not discussed as much. But let me get back to social communication.
I just ask one thing real quick and then go back there. We've talked to an Afghanistan, former legislator in Afghanistan who says the same thing you're saying, says the U.S. could do a lot better by supporting true democracy in Afghanistan. But she also says that that would entail actually funding and arming other factions than the ones that we fund and arm now.
Well, we fund the warlords.
Are there factions that you know of in Afghanistan that would be? That are akin to the kids in Tahrir Square?
Who knows how bad it's gone in Afghanistan? Are you kidding? After 10 years of American, we're back bombing again like crazy. I mean, the anti-Americanism is out of sight. Are you kidding? And also in Pakistan, we're just bombing again with drones and predators, pilotless planes. That's nice. I don't know why everybody doesn't say, well, if the drones and predators are so good, why are we paying all this money for an Air Force? But nobody gets to that budget issue. Air Force still runs around.
All right, social media.
But let me just tell you about relying on Twitter or Facebook for information. And for example, in Syria right now, most of the reporting we get is secondhand from Facebook people or people who are opposition. The Saudis are very hostile to the Syrian president, Bashar Assad, and they're pumping a lot of stuff in there. And so there's little – and this isn't a brief for Bashar. I wish he wasn't doing what he's doing, and he's a minority sect, an Alawite. And the country is dominated by Sunnis. And so in the long run, how long can he stay in power if they decide to get him? He's in the long run doomed. But in the short run, he's going to kill his way into some sort of settlement. And that's just the way it is in Syria. Here's what we do in the press. From a place like Syria, let's say, in which we're you know, one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist. You understand how it goes. We're much more – we look much more kindly on what the leadership in Bahrain did than we do to what Bashar did. There's a disparity there that nobody wants to deal with. You know, we look the other way at Bahrain because we have a lot of reasons to, and we don't look the other way at Bashar because we have a lot of reasons not to look the other way. We don't like him. He's too close to Hezbollah, et cetera, too close to Iran, et cetera, et cetera. In any case, so we rely on social network, Twitter and other stuff. And the American press will run Facebook stuff. Somebody will write something out of Facebook. That'll get into the newspapers. Just suppose you're walking past the White House at 3 o'clock. You're a young kid on Twitter, and the light's on. And you write, you go by and you write a note. You write a Twitter. You say, oh, my God, there's something going on. A lot of lights on in the White House. Something's happening. Nobody in the American press would give one hoot about a Twitter report. Why would we care about that? There's some guy writing about he sees lights out. But if the same sort of comment was made from somebody Twittering out of Syria, that's in the press because that's fact. It's just – it may be. It's just a whole new way. It's a whole nother problem. We got a lot of problems in the press. We got a lot of problems with the mainstream press. I always tell people that having worked at the New York Times, which is our best newspaper, and it was a pleasure to work there, and I had a great time. But having worked there, I can tell you that if there's going to be a social revolution in America, do not expect the New York Times or any of the mainstream media to lead it. They won't even know about it for 6 months. And I'm exaggerating, but certainly you're seeing it with the populist thing that's been going on in Wall Street. I mean, the first reaction of the New York Times was sort of a dainty dismissal, and often not so dainty. Just sort of, oh, my God, you know, give me a break. One of the columnists wrote a piece about a CEO called him up and said, would he go down and take a look and let him know what's going on? A CEO of a bank. I don't know the guy, a kid named Sorkin. I mean, he's written a good book. He's apparently a competent reporter. He writes a column about a CEO calling him up. And he went down and he reported, you know, the freak show that existed. And, of course, when people made fun of – were critical of his disdainful comments about this populist uprising and asked him who the CEO was, he wouldn't say. So it's don't expect the American press to push for anything. It's just not our function. We do okay, but people put too much hope in us.
What is the function of the American press? The mainstream media. Are you part of the mainstream media?
I stay in it. I work in the New Yorker. It's hard because the New Yorker has very stringent rules about sources and checks, and so does the New York Times. I mean, I don't do any. I work for the AP and UPI. Yeah, of course I am. I'm just against the narrative, which is always difficult because the narrative is so much easier. And particularly since I've obviously cultivated people that trust me and that are – I've had senior editors call me up and say to me, oh, even at the New York Times, I've had friends – I have friends there. I mean, I like the they're very competent people. I wish they do more, but that's not the way that's not what they see their vision. It's a more nuanced vision they have. But I've had them call up and say, look, you know, somebody at the Times once said, look, we have a lot of people. We see the Secretary of State. We see the National Security Advisor. This is in the Bush administration. We see Condoleezza Rice. But we don't have anybody inside who's a critic of the programs. And so, you know, I guess the implicit question was, would I cough up what I had to them or something? I don't know what it was. I have people who see the data, see the papers, and are critical of them. And that's a great position to be in. But it also puts me in a position where I'll write about an NIE, and I'll write more detail than other people can get. And so
– you've seen it?
Sometimes. Mostly the time I don't keep things. I don't – it's not in my office.
Right.
I wouldn't do that. I'd be crazy.
But, I mean, you've seen it. You know what's in it.
I've had three people, disparate people, say the same thing about certain things.
I see.
Fair enough. I mean, that's often more the fact than actually seeing a document. I'm not that eager to see stuff because, you know, I just don't want to be in a position where I can, you know, that's just it's a safety thing. Anyway, and I don't keep things in my office. Please, I don't keep things in my office. Leave me alone.
I like how you looked up like the microphones were in the ceiling. But yes, go ahead.
Anyway, so the point is that if you write something about an NIE and they call up and they say we can't comment because it's classified, you know, I'm sort of – it's a little bit of a screw situation because the New York Times isn't going to follow my story unless they can independently verify it. So the New York Times will still write stories like they did a few days ago about – unanswered questions. And there's a new leader of the International Atomic Energy Agency, a Japanese fellow, who replaced Mohammed El-Baradi, who was wonderful, very interesting. What a great book. Baradi was balanced and nuanced. People thought he was, because he was an Egyptian and a Muslim, that he wasn't. But he was very tough on Iran. The new guy is all I can say about him. We had that terrible disaster in Japan. Fukushima. It took him 3 weeks to get out there. Why? Because he didn't want to embarrass his former government. And talk about a government that has behaved more craven and more callously. I mean, the Japanese government has set a new low standard for protecting its citizen. The whole interest was protecting an industry and its reputation. I mean, their behavior, that government's behavior, was so odious. I mean, even in America, it's Katrina cubed. I'm serious. It's really – and so this is a guy that we're pushing. We have a lot of sway with. You know, a lot of people in the world really don't trust the UN. They see us as too closely involved. They don't trust the IE anymore. They see our power is too much involved. All of a sudden – and so the Times can write a long story about the UN unanswered questions and not mention the NIE, done by the American intelligence community, guys that are most – probably all voted Bush-Cheney, you know, or most of them did, and would again tomorrow. I mean, who are objective and honest, because we have a lot of very competent people in our intelligence committee. By the way, 99% of the people I know in the CIA and in the military want to do it right. I mean,
well,
that's, of course,
that's 99% want to do it right. Why do we end up – putting troops in Congo, maybe with not as much thought, or getting into Afghanistan
because
or Iran?
I think it's craven politics by this sort of disappointing
so
president.
So it's the 1%?
Well, I mean, we got a president that's, you know, it's OJT, learning on the job. You know, he's obviously wasn't.
You agree with that? That was the assessment 4 years ago when people were, whether they deciding it should be Hillary or him.
Yeah, he but was, you know, Hillary just, you know, Hillary's really smart. So is he. They're both very bright people. I can't believe some of the stuff Hillary says. She's out there, this new Iranian thing where we believe the Quds Force, this incredibly sophisticated Iranian force. You know, Iran, more of the Greek classics are translated into Farsi every year than in any other country.
You don't think they were responsible for a threat against
think,
the Saudi ambassador?
Look, it could be they were. It could be the government's absolutely right, and there's some wonderful secret stuff they're not sharing with us. I can tell you, everything they put out now, two bank transfers that they claim to know who originated the bank transfers. They were not even Iranian banks. They were foreign banks. Two bank transfers that they claim were traced back to somebody in Quds without showing it. I've never heard of a bank transfer that told you that much information, that they could trace it back to the guy who said, let's do it. I mean, certainly nobody's suggesting that anybody serious in Quds would directly be involved in a bank transfer, because that would be crazy. I mean, that's, you know, day one of how to run an operation. And secondly, the guy they're dealing with, this car salesman, the Yakuts, when these guys, they did some killing of dissidents in the 80s in places like Vienna. And I remember doing work on them. And one of the things about the Quds Force in Iran, and they probably don't do as much of this stuff now because they don't have that many dissidents left anymore, but they killed some people. And the Viennese did big investigations of it. And their investigations showed, for example, they would send the weapons earlier by pouch with all the numbers, you know, like in the movies, filed off or whatever the cliche is, sterile weapons. Then they would send people to scout out the scene. They would be sent undercover as diplomats or military attachés or what we call NOCs, non-official cover, a tradesman or something like that, were legitimate, but actually were intelligence agencies, other jobs seemingly. They would check the site. They would check the path. They spent weeks planning it, and they did a hit. So you're telling me that all of a sudden they're running around sending wires to a used car salesman that's been in and out of jail, that's got all sorts of money problems. It's such a bad story. It's a little terrifying that they actually think they can sell this.
All right, terrifying. Here, I got a minute left, or 2 minutes left. So terrifying. On that note, you've alluded to an administration that's on the job training, as you said. What does that say for the future of this of our problems in foreign policy, our problems in Iran, Iraq, the Middle East?
We're certainly in as bad a shape as we were when Bush Cheney left. Yeah, we're in worse shape.
Because we
set expectations that weren't met. America's disliked more than ever. Absolutely no question. I'm sorry to be a little Mary Sunshine about this.
That's good.
Economically, we're much poorer position than the Chinese. That's where we are. We're disliked more than ever.
Our economic position with China is...
China's got the money. We don't. China has, $2 trillion of our... They could embarrass us tomorrow by pulling out money. And you know, every day they stay in the dollar. You know, if the dollar gets devalued, they're losing a lot of money every day. But anyway, they're staying in. We're not in good shape economically. We're not the powerhouse we used to be. We're not as liked as well. Our foreign policy is much more difficult, and everybody's very disappointed with us.
This is the Obama stuff you're talking about.
What?
That's disappointed in Obama. We're speaking.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, who isn't? We all are. I mean, he's got the highest disapproval. He's a 54% unapproval, disapproval. And that's an amazingly high rate.
Do you see any clarity in Mitt Romney or Herman Cain?
No, I think Obama could win. And I have this fantasy that he's catering to the right and kowtowing to the stuff in Uganda, the stuff with the Tripoli, even showing he's tough. The surge in Afghanistan, not replacing Gates, not replacing Mullen, not replacing any of the military guys for stability to shore up his right. My assumption is, my fantasy is that he's going to win re-election narrowly, and he's going to prove to all of us that the guy he said he was in 08 during the campaign is the guy, and he's going to make some serious changes in the way America operates. But
you don't really believe that, do you?
How can I? But I want to tell myself that. Otherwise, my father was born in Lithuania. Can I get a passport from there? I don't know.
Seymour Hersh is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He's spent the last, you know what? How much time you spent, like the last six, 3 years, did you say, with Dick Cheney in your head?
A couple years with Dick Cheney. It's
in fun. Your head.
Oh, yeah.
It's fun.
By the way, here's the scary thing. In his new book, he's not lying. He believes it.
Sure.
Yeah.
I didn't think he was lying.
Straight out of DSM-4. The manuscript for mental illness.
Oh, great. All right. It was good talking to you, sir.
Sure.
I hope you'll come back.
Okay.
And we'll get you some real estate. This is Weekday.
Hear great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.